You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Times Higher Education podcast. Today we'll be coming down from the spires, pulling back the ivy, and exiting the cloisters to talk about young universities. Is disruption in their DNA? And what does it take for them to actually be successful? I'm Sarah Custer, and joining me today is John Morgan, our deputy news editor, and Tim Swoola, head of content and engagement for our Global Summit series. I also spoke with Renee Hinmarsh, the executive director of the Australian Technology Network of Universities. To start, I think it'd be a good idea to set a definition of what we mean by a young university for the purposes of this discussion. So, Tim, you've organized the Times Higher Education Young University Summit for next month that will take place at the University of South Florida. What was your criteria when you were putting together the program?
Well, technically, we have set the bar at 50 years since founding, but it is a very unstable bar with lots of universities on either side who we're including. So it's certainly not a very strict entry policy.
Okay, so 50 years old or younger. Can you talk just about some of the universities that are coming along to the summit and maybe a common characteristic that they would share?
Sure. I mean, I think in terms of the universities that are coming to the summit, it's partly 50 years because that's a parameter of the young university ranking that we have, but we also have a university, the Golden Age ranking, which goes back to 1945 up to 66.
So we're launching two rankings at the summit.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit what we mean by this Golden Age period?
I think that's really a reference, obviously, to the post-war expansion in higher education, which particularly took place in the US and clearly the UK as well, and you know, Germany, for example. So as a means of categorizing those universities that, you know, still had a desire, you know, I think particularly the institutions that kind of then hit the 50s found that transition difficult, not being in our ranking anymore and not, you know, still wanting to be noticed and recognized for what they're doing. We thought it, you know, be very important to still include those. So we had a Golden Age ranking that specifically looks at institutions in that era that I guess are in their sort of, you know, third generation, as it were, of leadership and governance compared to the younger upstarts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But obviously not as old as the traditional universities that have been around for centuries.
Yeah, clearly there's a big distinction there still.
Okay, so going back to what these younger institutions have in common, is there something that they all share?
Well, I guess that for particular universities that might have been founded within the same country and, you know, through the same, you know, legislation, you know, they might have had, you know, similar ethoses or you know, levels of funding available in a particular mission, you know, particularly with student outcomes and student success being a big part of their role, you know, opening up towards people who wouldn't traditionally have gone to universities. But then at the same time, you know, that we're not isolating the ranking to two or three countries either. So, you know, across the world, as it's a global ranking and global look, you know, there's clearly huge amounts of difference in the different types of universities that are there, you know, what resources they've had available and how they've dealt with that.
And are there any countries where we're seeing more of these younger universities popping up? I mean, other than there's some obvious places in the world where I would think that they're really trying to establish their higher education system. So are there any countries where you specifically focused whenever you were creating the content?
Not really, actually, no. I mean, clearly because it's in the US, it's hosted by the University of South Florida. So, you know, we're having a particularly stronger look at universities in that North America region. So Canada, Mexico and the US. But in terms of the wider point of, you know, where are the younger universities coming from? I mean, that will be clearly a big topic of discussion. I think it's really interesting because, you know, there is a reality of the supply line, you know. So although, you know, we hear all the time about the need to expand in higher education in India, for example, I don't think anybody would really wish to set up new universities if they couldn't fill them with, you know, the right caliber of students and the right caliber of faculty. So until, you know, primary and secondary education systems are able to produce the right number of, you know, the right quality of student and people eager to learn, you've probably hit perhaps a critical mass of the number of new universities that can spring up and be founded, certainly in terms of institutions that have a genuine, you know, mission to teach, to learn, you know, to create new knowledge and prepare, you know, new graduates.
And is the part of the aim of the ranking to boost the prestige of younger universities, because we often see in so many countries that there's this hierarchy of prestige that is often very strongly linked to age of the institution. So I wonder whether that helps in some way, shine a spotlight on the achievements of younger universities, although probably in kind of the main rankings they may still end up being outshone by older, more established rivals.
Yeah, I mean, from pretty much every university senior leader or researcher that I've spoken to, you know, is proud of where they do in the ranking. They might believe they should be even higher up, but you know, it's certainly not something they're ashamed of. So there's an element of celebrating achievement and rewarding progress, or equally, you know, clearly highlighting areas to improve upon. So I think it's probably important for young universities in particular to be able to demonstrate that, okay, so they might not be on a par with, you know, some the big hitters that have, you know, 300, 400 years of prestige, but they're still doing some remarkable things, and, you know, they deserve a spotlight on that.
Yeah, often in a really short space of time when you think about the centuries that the biggest names have had to establish themselves.
Well, exactly.
It's quite remarkable.
I mean, there are some universities that are high in our young ranking that, you know, that really do, you know, are up there in the top 100, top 200 in the whole world. I mean, what they're able to achieve is remarkable if you're focusing in on those kinds of metrics.
Yeah, and one of the advantages that young universities say that they have is this ability to be agile and to disrupt the system. Are there any that either one of you have noticed that you think are really achieving this?
Well, I think that, you know, quite clearly, KAIST, for example, in Korea, which was, and I don't have it in front of me, so I can't, but it's founded, I think, around 30 years ago, so it would still be a younger university, and that's doing extremely well. That's got a very hugely ambitious president, Sung Chul Shin. You know, they're trying to set themselves up as, you know, the MIT of East Asia, and you know, producing some groundbreaking works and groundbreaking research, and, you know, feature very heavily in our coverage editorially quite often. So that would certainly be one.
And the University of California institutions, those new ones, seem like they're extremely successful. I don't know whether they come into the young universities or the golden age.
Yeah.
The expansion of the University of California seems like it's been really successful in terms of creating very high quality institutions.
Yeah. I guess, I mean, from my, you know, the conversations that I've had at Young Summits in the past, you know, it seems to be more about being able to really focus strategies and think about how you want the university to be in the now and in the future, and not have any kind of concerns about, you know, are we, you know, respecting our heritage, or, you know, beholden to our legacy, or, you know, encumbered perhaps by a particular wishes of donors or something like that. You know, so it gives deans and you know, senior leadership real flexibility in designing, you know, new curricula, you know, changing the whole structure of, you know, how a faculty might look, you know, being much more interdisciplinary, you know, working with new industry. And clearly the, you know, they might not have the benefits of really famous alumni who've won, you know, Nobel Prizes, Fields Medals and things like that, because they may only have literally one or two generations of alumni. But on the other hand, again, it also means they're able to focus on what their students are doing right now, or, you know, what their students have achieved very recently. And so that will naturally create a whole change of ethos on the campus and beyond.
In a way, it's liberating for them to not have that, to not be so steeped in tradition. And another institution that we've covered quite a bit on THE, and a former host of one of the summits, is SUSTEC in China. They were, I think they're 7 years old, eight years old now.
7 years old, yeah.
And I mean, just like the pace of development on their campus, from what I've been told, just the level of facilities and massive ambitions to try to establish themselves as a global player is just quite astonishing.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I was lucky to go there in February, and it's remarkable, the sheer drive they have to do something. But, you know, absolutely, they always talk about doing something new. They never talk about, you know, doing something emulating their older peers, in whether it be in China or the region or anywhere else. So it's, yeah, I think, you know, young universities are a really exciting place to be, and that's partly why at the summit we've got speakers coming in from older universities. So Andy Hamilton, the, you know, president of NYU, former vice chancellor of the University of Oxford, is the opening keynote speaker, because clearly, you know, he's come from a place 800 year plus institution, and then NYU, but they're NYU's international model means that, you know, they've got branches all around the world now, and so possibly they're in the best of both worlds and being able to have that heritage and that prestige of being New York University, but equally the nimbleness and the flexibility that comes with having a completely new operation.
Right.
So, you know, that's essentially what we want to hear from him about.
Yeah, so that is interesting, because we were talking about setting up new universities. Sometimes that happens on the back of a big population boom, like we saw in the US and the UK in the 40s and 50s, and what we're seeing now in India and Nigeria. But it could also be because of established universities or starting kind of branch universities or startup institutions in other countries, so they can have that agileness. But then it's also the formation of some old universities coming together and being slapped with the label of universities, which is what we've seen quite a bit in the UK, specifically with the post-92 group, right?
That's right. So what we would call post-1992 universities, or modern universities, as they often like to brand themselves, these were institutions that prior to 1992 were polytechnics, but the then conservative government allowed them to become universities in 1992, and this mm-hmm. was aimed at sort of equalizing the funding system, because universities tended to got more funding per student than the polytechnics. So it was aimed at, you know, creating a more equal system in terms of funding. And then those institutions have since gone on to do the real heavy lifting in terms of the expansion of higher education since then, and the widening participation agenda. So they've really been essential to what's happened in British higher education since 1992.
So you mentioned that they were given university status in an attempt to level the playing field a little bit. Do you think that's happened since they were given that status?
In terms of prestige in the eyes of a lot of people in politics and the media, probably not. Seen a few notable examples of snobbery towards the post-92s. Recently you've had Andrew Adonis say that it was a mistake to let the polytechnics become universities, and he said that that the government should ensure that former polytechnics aren't allowed to charge the highest level of fees, which is quite interesting coming in the context when there's a major funding review taking place. Other people have pointed out that if you did that, then you would be lowering funding for the institutions that have the highest proportions of poor students, which would be a strange policy from a social mobility or social equality perspective. And you also had recently Nick Timothy, who is Theresa May's former advisor. He used a Telegraph column to lament the fact that he'd had his hair cut by a Southampton Solent University football studies graduate, which anecdote then led on to him making some arguments about people who choose the wrong institutions, in his words, and the fact that they're not able to access good graduate jobs. This is, in his view, an argument for the fact that we should be reducing the number of people who go to university. And Nick Timothy was, when he was advisor to the Prime Minister, before he was asked to stop doing that, he was the driving force behind the Tories having this policy to review tertiary education funding mm-hmm. in their manifesto, which has now led on to the review of post-education funding that we see in play at the moment.
Right. And from your expert opinion, John, how do you think that's going to play out for this post-92 group of universities? What's going to come out with this after this higher education funding review?
Well, ministers, including the Prime Minister, have sort of lamented the fact that there isn't any competition in terms of tuition fees and price. So there clearly is a drive for ministers to see variation in tuition fees, and that is one of the questions that the review posed in the initial consultation, which has just closed. How, if we were going to go about introducing competition and price, what would be the best way to do it? So the implication there, you might think, is either that the government wants to see different fees between different kinds of subjects, some courses having higher fees, some lower, or it wants them to vary between different kinds of institutions, with the most prestigious universities allowed to charge higher fees and those that are less prestigious charging lower fees, and you could get to a system like that if you wish to by setting fee caps according to the graduate earnings of the people who go to those universities. So, and if you just did it without any benchmarking or adjusting for people's social background when they come in, that would be, if you did it on graduate earnings, that would very much penalise post 1992 universities, because their graduates, if you just look at it without benchmarking, have lower earnings, but that's because they tend to come from more disadvantaged social backgrounds. So that is one potential outcome of the funding review, and it's met with quite a strong and surprising united response from universities in response to the review's consultation. Pretty much everyone from the Russell Group to Million Plus to Universities UK said, don't try and create variation in tuition fees. If you did that, you might end up cutting funding for institutions that have the greatest proportions of disadvantaged students. Right. So, but this issue of, you know, new institutions and hierarchies of prestige is very much a live one in terms of funding.
Yeah, it sounds like that could go back to the two-tier system that was, that the whole post-92 group was created initially to eliminate.
Yeah, the conservative government sort of turning back the clock and reversing a policy that a conservative government introduced. For what it's worth, Theresa May is someone who has said in the past that the polytechnics lost their way when they became universities. She voiced that opinion in a 2007 interview with Times Higher Education when she was Shadow Education Secretary. So whether that view comes into play, we will see.
I mean, it is a challenge. I can only imagine setting up a university or even creating a university of as a conglomerate of other established institutions. In the feature article that is coming out for the supplement for our Young University Rankings, our reporter Ellie Bothwell spoke with Philip Altback, who said that setting up a university requires a lot of money, vision, and talent, which I'm sure is something that wasn't lacking for these universities whenever they were first formed, but I'm sure is definitely easy to maybe lose sight of as you're going along. If we're talking about having disruption in your DNA, are there any institutions in this post-92 group, John, that you think stand out in terms of really kind of driving home the message of a modern university?
Well, if there's one modern university that's been sort of successful in that game of chasing national prestige, then it's probably Coventry University in recent years. That's done particularly well in the Guardian league table, and Times Higher produces this table of tables based on the main domestic newspaper league tables. It's kind of a very rough and ready exercise, but Coventry became the first post 1992 university to feature in the table of tables in 2015. So Coventry's been pretty innovative in setting up a lower cost offshoot for sort of part-time and mature students. Possibly that's, I don't know whether that's part of the way that the main university has been able to boost its prestige, perhaps as the entry thresholds of the university have gone up as the lower cost offshoot was introduced. I'm not quite sure on the picture on that. But yeah, certainly Coventry's earned a lot of recognition on that. But there was an interesting ranking produced by The Economist last year, which looked at actual value added in terms of the graduate earnings figures on universities, rather than just looking at them without taking into account people's social background and where the university is against its regional earnings figures. And once you do take regional earnings figures and the social background of entrance into account, The Economist found that actually it was newer universities that were doing the best on graduate earnings. I think their league table of value added was topped by the University of Portsmouth, which is a post 92 university, and then in second was Aston University, which is a former College of Advanced Technology, became a university in the 60s, and then third was Newman University, which is a Catholic institution that only became a university in 2010. So there are a variety of ways to look at it, and if you look at it in terms of value added in, you know, getting people decent earnings from poorer backgrounds and in parts of the country that don't have high earnings, then you could say that it's newer universities that are being the most innovative.
Yeah, that social mobility, which I think is something that a lot of universities that we're considering young here are doing quite successfully, even beyond the UK. which makes me wonder, beyond chasing international talent and having this vision as a university, doesn't it really just come down to what students think? I mean, do you think students really pay attention to when a university was founded? Does that matter? Does age matter to them?
I don't think so. I think that what does matter actually is probably more what recruiters think, because that obviously then impacts what students think, you know, particularly if you're having to pay for your education, because, you know, it might be that, yeah, you can get, you know, great value add from going to the University of Portsmouth or something like that, but that potentially depends a bit more on what your aspiration might be as well. So, yeah, it makes no difference perhaps to the quality of teaching and learning, you know, what year your university was founded. But in terms of the outcome that you might have, you know, you're still, if a recruiter's going to consider people who come from those big prestigious, you know, heritage institutions and perhaps completely wrongly ignore the new post-92 universities or their equivalents somewhere else around the world, then that makes a big difference still.
So when you say recruiter, you're talking employment recruiter?
Yeah, employment
after you
recruiter,
graduate.
Yeah. So it's the value that they have on a degree rather than the value of, you know, the education or the value that you as a student will have.
Mm. Yeah, I'd spoken to Clifford Chance, a law firm, and they introduced CV blind recruitment, where you can't see the name of the school or university that people attended at a certain stage of the recruitment process. So yeah, that's an idea that is around, and probably it would make sense for the post 92 universities to be really driving that agenda and, you know, getting employers to look past the name of the institution and its age, so people can escape more from this hierarchy of age and prestige.
Yeah, that's the big thing. I mean, you know, we can't, and whenever we, you know, we have our summits, we really try and push that we're not talking just about higher education in isolation. And, you know, we try and take our heads out of the sand a little bit and get the perspective of the regulators, get the perspective of the industry. And so at the Young Summit, for example, we've got the Chinese telecoms global giant Huawei is hosting a dinner where we'll be talking, and they, you know, they've globally recruit tens of thousands of graduates every year with, you know, from sort of the STEM backgrounds particularly. But, you know, we really want to find out from them about their perspectives of universities and the quality of education, teaching, learning, and what young universities mean to them. I mean, Huawei themselves are based in Shenzhen in China, which is the home of Sustech, the university we mentioned earlier. So I think, you know, within the Chinese market, its recruitment is very different to how it might be in the UK. But you have to think about young universities and how they're perceived beyond the higher education sector rather than just purely within it.
Right. And those relationships is something that is really important, not just with employers, but between young universities themselves. And that was something that I spoke with Renee Hinmarsh, the executive director of the Australian Technology Network of Universities, how this group is using collaboration as a way to forge ahead with their mission.
Renee, do you want to just start off telling me what the Australian Technology Network does?
Yeah, so we are a national consortium of five large innovative universities. So our members are RMIT, University of Technology Sydney, QUT, Curtin Uni and University of South Australia. And I guess the underpinning benefit framework of the ATN is that any activities of the consortium will bring benefit to the members that are greater than what they could have achieved on their own. And there's three main areas of focus in terms of what my team and I do at the ATN. The first is advocacy and policy. The second is working together to identify and capitalise on international opportunities, and that might be either student or research opportunities. And the third one is ensuring that policies and frameworks are in place to make us the network of choice for industry collaboration. And that's a whole spectrum of things, from work integrated learning, industry research training. We've also standardised our approach to intellectual property across the five universities. So we do everything we can to make it more attractive for industry to engage with our members.
You've touched on it a little bit, but can you tell me a bit more about the activities and achievements that a group like yours is able to go forward with that universities maybe on their own would not be able to achieve?
Yeah, I think, so let's start with the first one, the advocacy and policy. I think by working together, we have a national footprint, and we have scale being representative of 20% of the Australian higher education sector by student numbers.
Your group represents 20% of the Australian higher education sector?
Yeah, in terms of student numbers.
Wow. Okay.
So, it gives us a much stronger platform to make the case for advocacy and policy than any of our members would be able to achieve on their own. And in terms of the international opportunities, it's the same principle. So being young universities, we don't always have the same established reputation in international markets that some older universities might have. And so by working together, we've been able to really effectively bring the focus onto the ATN universities and achieve real outcomes for our members.
We are talking today on our podcast about the advantages and strengths that young universities have. And for the purposes of our discussion, we're talking about universities that are 50 years old or younger. So what's the average age of your group?
25.
Okay. And is there, would you say there's one characteristic that young universities have in common?
For me, I think even though there is a great diversity amongst young universities, one thing that they do have in common is that they're not burdened by centuries of tradition or bureaucracy. And I think that it allows them to be a bit more agile and responsive to opportunities and to be able to pivot when the opportunity arises. So that might be around engaging with industry needs, or it might be crafting opportunities for students and teaching in a different way. But I think they're a bit more willing to challenge the status quo and do things a little bit differently.
Yeah, that agility is something that we've heard several young universities say they've got on their side. I'm wondering, what are some of the challenges that these institutions face? I mean, reputation is obviously a big one. They're competing on prestige as well. What have you found among your group members?
Yeah, I think reputation is probably the biggest one because it's something that develops over time, and being known for what you're good at takes time. And these universities have invested and are now producing world-class research in a whole range of areas, but getting that out there and making it known is a really big challenge, I think.
Do you think they struggle to attract global talent because of their age?
Oh, look, I think reputation impacts a whole lot of things. So everything from research rankings, staff and student recruitment, and how you interact with governments is all largely built on, well, not completely built on, but certainly a little bit reliant on reputation. And so, of course, it has an impact, but the young universities, I think, by working together, are certainly challenging this and forging their own path.
And do you think students pay attention to the age of universities?
No. I think in the Australian context, potentially when we saw the introduction of a lot more universities in the Australian sector about 25 years ago, that may have been a bit more of a factor, but certainly not in the Australian context now. I think students look for things like graduate outcomes and the quality of the teaching and learning experience that they get on campus, the quality of industry engagement, and the likelihood that they will get a job at the end. So I think they're the things that they look for rather than how old their institution is.
And when you found, whenever you are reaching out to industry and graduate employers, is that something that they pay attention to as well, the history of the university?
Oh, I think it depends. I mean, obviously, people have perceptions based on their own experience at universities. So if you went to a particular university, then you may have a fondness for it that you may not have for other institutions. But that changes over time as the universities get older and they become a more entrenched part of the fabric of higher education in their environment, and age becomes less relevant. And I think industry looks for what type of partner that institution is, what are the quality of their graduates, what the quality of their research is, and how responsive they are to the needs of industry.
That was Renee Hindmarsh of the Australian Technology Network of Universities, who will be chairing a panel at the Times Higher Education Young University Summit, which is taking place on June 5th through the 7th at the University of South Florida in Tampa. And both John, you and Tim will be at the summit. So if you're attending, be sure to come grab them and say hello. If you aren't able to attend the summit, you can follow the conversation on the Twitter feed. What's the Twitter feed, Tim?
It is THE World Summit.
At THE World Summits. That's all we've got time for. Thanks so much for joining me, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll see you next week.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.